free, but you can give it to the birds and bees. I need some money, need some money, oh yeah, what I want.
Hey, Chris Garlock here with this week's Labor History Today.
If the businesses didn't carry these African-American made products, the Housewives League would encourage people to not shop at these merchants.
That's Allie Penn talking about the Housewives League of Detroit, whose informal motto was, "Don't buy where you can't work." The league was founded in 1930 by Fannie Peck to unite and empower black housewives in Detroit while also strengthening the economic base of the black community. Allie, a Wayne State History PhD candidate, archivist, and former Reuther Library staff member, talked with Tales from the Reuther Library podcast host Dan Galadner. Also on this week's show, Labor History in 2 tells the story of Oscar Niebe, one of the 8 men convicted of inciting violence at a workers' rally at Haymarket Square in Chicago in 1886. Finally, from our own archives, today we find out about a former union building right in downtown D.C. that you've probably passed many times without realizing the key role it played in American labor history.
Everyone walks by pretty fast, missing a small plaque attached to the building that identifies it as a National Historic Landmark.
Okay, here's the show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1850. That was the birthday of Oscar Niebe. Niebe was one of 8 men convicted of inciting violence at a workers' rally at Haymarket Square in Chicago in 1886. He was born in New York City, where he became a skilled tinsmith. He moved to Chicago in 1877, where he worked at the Adams-Westlake Manufacturing Company. He was fired and blacklisted when he tried to organize his fellow workers. This, however, did not stop his organizing efforts. Oscar founded his own business, the Acme Yeast Company, and turned his attention to organizing brewery workers. He was active in the Chicago Central Labor Union. By 1886, the labor movement was growing in power and action in Chicago. On May 1st, thousands took to the streets in strikes and demonstrations for the 8-hour workday. 3 days later, a bomb was thrown by an unknown assailant at a workers' rally protesting police violence against demonstrators. No one knows to this present day who threw the bomb. 8 men were tried and convicted for the crime. Oscar Niebe was sentenced to 15 years in prison in Joliet, Illinois. 4 of his fellow accused were executed by the hangman's rope. After 6 years in prison, Niebe was pardoned by Illinois Governor John Peter Altgeld. His first wife died shortly after the trial. It is said she died of a broken heart. At his trial, Niebe wrote, quote, "I have been in the labor movement since 1875. I have seen how the police have trodden on the Constitution of this country and crushed the labor organizations. I am sorry I am not to be hung with the rest of the men."
Hi, Allie. Thanks so much for joining our podcast.
Hi, Dan.
This is kind of a general question. So what was the Detroit Housewives League?
So that's kind of an interesting question. And so I'll tell sort of the broader story. Is the Housewives League was an organization that was founded in Detroit in 1930. And so to sort of set the scene, the Great Depression had just started in 1929. And so blacks in the city of Detroit were already more at risk to lose their jobs due to racism that existed within the city and within industry at that time. And so the Housewives League was an organization that was founded to encourage black family members, black communities to shop at black owned businesses. And it was sort of a way to promote the community in order to help everyone survive at this troubling time. And their motto was to stabilize the economy of the Negro through direct spending, so shopping at these black owned businesses, or more informally, don't buy where you can't work. And so that was really the goal of the organization, is to protect these businesses, but to also create opportunity for their families and, you know, themselves in a lot of ways.
Okay, so where did this idea come from?
So the idea for the Housewives League, it came from Fannie Peck, who was the founder and then president of the Housewives League. And she was actually listening to a lecture from the National Negro Business League. And he was talking about the power that housewives can have within their household. And to Fannie, this idea was mind-blowing because she knew what her life was like. And the idea that the housewife held this power but didn't know that she held this power and that she could utilize this power to help her community was astonishing. I mean, housewives controlled, at this time, Black housewives controlled 85% of the household spending. And especially at this particular moment, the housewives themselves were also usually the breadwinner. A lot of Black women stayed employed during the Great Depression as domestic laborers, as maids and cooks and cleaners, et cetera. And so, you know, not only were they bringing in the money, but they were in control of spending that money.
Who would join the Housewife League?
You know, honestly, it was kind of a community-wide organization. I mean, it was really Black housewives throughout the city of Detroit. And actually, you know, when Fannie started the organization in 1930, she gathered together 50 women that she knew. And it went from, you know, in 1930 being 50 women to in 1935, just 5 years later, being over 10,000 women.
Wow.
The city of Detroit was so large that actually they had to split into 16 neighborhood groups within the Housewives League just so that they could actually, you know, work with as many members as wanted to be a part of the group.
Oh my God, this is like a huge organization. So what kind of activities did they do then?
So they did a lot of different things. I mean, they sponsored tours of different businesses like the Great Lakes Insurance Company and Old Governor's Coffee Company to sort of give a behind the scenes look to shoppers to sort of encourage them to buy goods at these stores. They would go to merchants and request products that were made by African-American businesses, like the Parker House sausage, for example. And if the businesses didn't carry these African-American made products, the Housewives League would encourage people to not shop at these merchants. And so it was really incentivizing the merchants to then go and purchase these black owned businesses, these Black owned products in order to get that market, in order to get people to purchase goods from them. They also did things like scholarship essays for students to sort of create opportunities for students to be able to go to college, to be able to go to, you know, further education. And they also did monthly events to educate homemakers, like things on budgeting, things on health, and educating them about, you know, hygiene and public health items, and then reusing household goods, because, you know, this was the Great Depression after all.
No, this was like amazing. They're pulling these boycotts going on during the Depression. They're empowering neighborhoods. These are things that we hear about, you know, throughout the decades, and we never really heard about the Detroit Housewives League before. This is really cool. I mean, so they also, how did they get their communications going? Do they have a newspaper? Did they use flyers? How'd they do their PR, basically?
Yes. So the Housewives League was fortunate to have the Booker T. Washington Trade Association to lean on. The Housewives League is kind of considered the female auxiliary, the female counterpart of the Booker T. Washington Trade Association. And so the Housewives League was able to utilize their publication, The Voice of Negro Business, to, you know, put in notices about scholarship competitions or their homemaker events. But they also did their own, you know, efforts. They would host just neighborhood meetings at like the local YMCA or church or club and invite people all throughout the community. They also had their own newsletter. So they had their ways of staying in communication with each other.
Excellent. So, all right. Part of this project that you were working on, you created a story map, right?
That's correct.
And this was based on the advertisements in the Voice of Negro Business?
Yeah. So it's hard to say exactly where, you know, I decided to do this. I digitized collections from the Housewives League as part of a grant project I'd worked on. And so when I was in my African American history and memory class in the fall semester, I thought, I want to do something on the Housewives League because, as you've pointed out, it's not a very well-known organization. And so I thought, well, let me go look at the collections over at the Detroit Public Library and see what I can find in there. And within, you know, just looking through the collection, just sort of going box to box, I found a clipping of the Voice of Negro Business. And I was reading it and I was like, well, this is amazing. And so I went up to the archivist and said, do you have the full run of this? Do you have like the full newspaper? Mm-hmm. And he had to consult like three different of their like collection guides because no one had ever pulled the Voice of Negro Business before. And mm-hmm. so he actually found it and then went to pull it and then said, no one's ever asked for this before. And so I think I was like the first person to look at this in his memory, which is 15 to 20 years. And so from there, I just was flipping through it and thought, you know, this would be a great idea because my professor was really encouraging us to think of non-traditional projects, like not necessarily, you know, the old fashioned paper, but to think outside of the box. And I liked the story map idea to create something more like accessible. And so, yeah, it went from there to using the advertising, the advertisements within the Voice of Negro Business to build this map.
So what does the map actually show? I mean, we'll have a link in our webpage to get to it. But, you know, just describe what this map's going to look like and how researchers can use it.
Yeah, so actually I'm hoping to move it to a different system because I like StoryMap. It's just, I'm not really telling a story like that needs to flip, like that needs to go, you know, page to page. And I'm hoping to move it to more where you can click into different businesses if you know their location. Right now it's great because it reflects the trends of, you know, urban renewal and as people, you know, refer to it Negro removal. And so the map mm-hmm. goes from 1938 to 1945, because that's the run of the Voice of Negro Business that the Detroit Public Library had. And so it shows these thriving business communities in areas like Paradise Valley and Black Bottom, but also in areas where the current medical center is, or, you know, where Ford Field is or Comerica Park. And so right. it shows these thriving business communities. I mean, in 1955, African Americans owned and operated more businesses in Detroit than in any other American city. And so the map is like showing these thriving business communities. And then at the same time, it shows, you know, it reflects the idea that these businesses and these areas were destroyed for racial bias more than, you know, that they were slums as the government claimed when they were destroying these areas.
So you're going to take this project all the way up to about 1960 when 375 was built, as well as, what is it? On the other side, it was the lodge, wasn't it? Am I correct that they built down and destroyed businesses?
Yeah, the lodge, and then I'm pretty sure it's 375. So actually the way StoryMap works is that it pins it on locations that are currently exist. Mm-hmm. And so the way you can see it is like any business that's really on Hastings Street is now on the Chrysler Service Drive, because that's what Hastings is now, is it's the Chrysler Service Drive. And so I've really tried to be true to, you know, what was there in the map. And so if it's on the Chrysler Service Drive, that's its current address. I list in the image with the image, and, you know, I say original address, you know, like 514 Hastings Street. So that people know that just because it shows it's on the Chrysler Service Drive, it wasn't always on the Chrysler Service Drive. And I think that's really important.
That's what I say. This is so important. That's such a cool project you're doing. It's so important to histography, basically. It shifts what is basically a paper into a more visual, right? Is that so you get more impact, right? All right. What I was referring to earlier was I didn't really hear about the Detroit Housewives League until about, you know, a couple of years ago, specifically when you were working on the project. Why do you think that is? And do you think there's going to be a change within the study of Detroit away from that male-centric union business thing to more of who was actually running Detroit? You know, women controlling the budgets, women running things, leading strikes, and so forth and so on. Do you see a shift there?
You know, I think the Housewives League kind of creates an interesting opportunity, just because I think that the Housewives League pushes back against sort of the two things that you said. First off, the Housewives League kind of had to exist because blacks weren't allowed in unions. And I mean, traditionally, the work that the Housewives League did, the sort of boycotting and education activities, would have been taken on by women's auxiliaries of unions. And because, you know, blacks were kept out of these unions, the Housewives League created these opportunities. And then the second point is, like you said, the gender role. And I think that that's something that we're seeing, you know, now, is that housewives, or like women in general, is a growing trend in history because they've always been there. It's just that no one's really focused on them, and it's harder to find them within the historical narrative. And so I think that that's part of the reason it hasn't been done, is because as someone who studies women's history a lot, it's very tiring and exhausting, but in the best possible way. Because, for example, for my master's essay, I wrote on a nurse anesthetist from the University of Michigan, and I dug through, like, I would say 50 plus boxes at the Bentley Historical Library, and I maybe found 10 pieces of paper that had her name on it, even though she worked at the University of Michigan for 30 plus years in their hospital system, in their medical school. And I think that this is just something that the Housewives League also represents, is it's that, you know, people don't necessarily think about what housewives are doing. And I think that the Housewives League specifically doesn't get a lot of attention because they tried really hard to be apolitical. They didn't really want to be, you know, pushing up against politics, and they really tried to be anti-religious. While they did meet in churches because that's where a lot of, you know, black community organization happened, they didn't really go out of their way to be a religious organization. They just wanted to be a community organization.
You are so right when you say it's very exhausting. I hear that from a lot of researchers doing exactly what you're doing, digging even further down into historical narrative about those that we haven't talked about yet. And they're having a hard time trying to find it. But when they do find those few, you can make a whole paragraph, you make a whole chapter about those few pages. So that's great that you're still pursuing that. I mean, it needs to be, the stories need to be out there. Now, yes, tiring and exhausting. So what are the sources you looked at to make you so tired, you know?
Well, I think this project is exciting because it is tiring, in that there's a lot of great materials out there. And I probably started, honestly, in one of the worst places, because the Booker T. Washington Trade Association and the Housewives League, both collections are at the Burton Historical Collection at the Detroit Public Library. But both of these collections have like guidebooks or sort of like pamphlets and brochures that contain the different businesses within the organization. Mm-hmm. But I was just obsessed with the newspaper because I wanted to see what businesses were saying about themselves. And a lot of the businesses included pictures of the business within their advertisements. And I loved that. And so while I could have started with, you know, a booklet that had, that didn't require me to do as much data entry and didn't require me to rope my sister into being my research assistant and working on the project with me, this was my favorite place to start, just because there were so many businesses and there was so much data to be entered that it was just amazing. And like right now the map has, I think, maybe 150 businesses in it, but the spreadsheet, like the backlog of data that I have to enter into the map, is like, we're up to over 500 businesses.
Oh my gosh.
That's just how big the project is. And so while it's exhausting and tiring, it's exhausting and tiring in the best possible way, because there are so many of these businesses that it's just creating like just such an intricate map of Detroit. And I will say, while I mentioned Paradise Valley and Black Bottom, it's not specifically in those neighborhoods. If you were anywhere within the city of Detroit and you were listed in here, you're on the map. Like, I'm not focusing on specific neighborhoods. I'm focusing on anything or any business that advertised within the Housewives League. And so I think that that's really important.
It is. That's why I noticed on the map that there was a little cluster on the west side.
Yeah.
Where the lodge is. So, and it was like, wow, it just surrounds Corktown a little bit over. So yes. Yeah, so you're getting a lot of information in this map. Is there anywhere people can look at this information online? I mean, I know you mentioned on a digitizing project. Is this stuff online?
So the Burton Collection has a lot of digital resources. And so if you Googled, I'm not sure what the exact link is, but if you Googled Digital Collections Detroit Public Library, you would find it. And they've done a lot of really good work digitizing the Housewives League. So a lot of the Housewives League materials and the Booker T. Washington Trade Association, those materials are all available online and they're accessible. So.
See, that's cool. See, this part of this podcast is also to let people know out around there, since researchers are not going into archives anymore or libraries for now, it's good to know these resources are online that they can use them to continue with their work. So that's cool. Allie, thank you so much for sharing this story and your project with us. I appreciate
it. No problem.
Today we find out about a former union building right in downtown D.C. that you've probably passed many times without realizing the key role it played in American labor history. Here's Labor History Today's Eleanor Mahoney.
I'm standing at the corner of 15th and I Streets Northwest, in front of a six-story building. The exterior is a mix of limestone, bluestone, and brick. It has offices on the ground level and then private residences higher up. Across the street is a park, McPherson Square, and the Metro's Orange and Blue Line stop is nearby. Traffic is stop and go, and pedestrians are a mix of tourists and downtown office workers. Everyone walks by pretty fast, missing a small plaque attached to the building that identifies it as a National Historic Landmark. For over 60 years, 900 15th Street Northwest was home to the United Mine Workers of America, one of the most influential unions in American labor history. Under the leadership of John L. Lewis, the union played a major role in improving working conditions and pay for coal miners. The union bought the building in 1936, 2 years after moving its headquarters from Indianapolis to Washington, D.C. Before that, the building had served as a social club for Washington's economic and political elite. 1936 was a pivotal year for the American labor movement. The country was still in the midst of the Great Depression. Unemployment hovered around 20%. Strike activity reached its highest level in two decades. And the nation's leading labor organization, the American Federation of Labor, or AFL, was in an uproar. Some of its largest affiliates, including the mine workers, had just formed the Committee for Industrial Organization, or CIO. Dedicated to organizing workers in mass production industries like steel and automobiles, the CIO would soon split from the AFL entirely into the rival Congress of Industrial Organizations. The leader of this breakaway group was John L. Lewis, the longtime president of the mine workers. Lewis was a larger-than-life figure, and at the time was probably the best-known labor leader in the U.S. With his piercing eyes and perpetual scowl, Lewis was well-known to labor supporters and opponents alike. He had a booming voice and trademark speaking style. Here he is addressing Congress following a deadly mining disaster in Centralia, Illinois.
Then before God I assert that those who consume the coal, and you and I who benefit from that service because we live in comfort, we owe protection to those men first, and we owe the security for their families if they die.
Having a presence in Washington, D.C. was incredibly important for the labor movement during the pivotal years of the 1930s. The decade was a turning point in relations between the federal government and unions. Never before, and never since, had the state intervened so decisively to support workers' rights to bargain collectively. By purchasing its new headquarters building just a few blocks from the White House, the Mine Workers Union was making a statement. It was a force to be reckoned with, and, along with the other CIO unions, a key component of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal coalition. Even though John L. Lewis himself was a lifelong Republican and actually supported Roosevelt's opponent, Wendell Willkie, in 1940. After Roosevelt's victory in the election, protesters hung banners on the front of the UMWA building, calling on Lewis to resign his leadership in the CIO. It's worth noting that anti-union media reports often highlighted, quite gleefully it seemed, the building's opulent appearance. They called it a mansion, or even a palace, not befitting a workers' organization. Another interesting story related to the building is how it fits in to the conflict between the AFL and the CIO. in 1938 with tensions at a peak between the two rival labor federations. The secretary of the D.C. Central Labor Union, an AFL affiliate, accused the mine workers of heating their headquarters building with oil and not coal. An insult, the Central Labor Union argued, to the thousands of unemployed miners suffering the effects of the Great Depression. Local media reported happily on the disagreement. The mine workers retorted that of course the building was being heated by anthracite coal. The AFL and the CIO would eventually merge again in 1955, becoming the AFL-CIO. In 1999, after 6 decades in downtown D.C., the mine workers sold the building, which was designated a National Historic Landmark in 2005. The union's offices are now in Prince William County, Virginia. But if you find yourself by McPherson Square, you can take a stroll over to 900 15th Street for a look at a building that was once at the center of labor policy making and organizing during the New Deal and post-World War II period. For Labor History Today, this has been Eleanor Mahoney.
I need some money, honey. I need some money right away. I need some money so bad. I need some money. Oh, yeah. What I want.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe on your favorite podcast app, and even better, if you like what you hear, please like it in your podcast app and pass it along. You can be part of Labor History Today by reading a labor history item. Just shoot us a note, laborhistorytoday@gmail.com. Music today was I Need Some Money by John Lee Hooker. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Chloe Daniel, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Jessica Pawsak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history, and see you next time.
I need some money. I need some money.